Everybody who has a dog calls the dog Spot or Blackie or Fido. I call my dog Sex. Now, Sex has been very embarrassing to me. When I went to City Hall to renew his dog license, I told the clerk I'd like to have a license for Sex. He said, I'd like to have one too. I said, but this is a dog. He said he didn't care what she looked like. Then I said, you don't understand. I've had Sex since I was 9 years old. He said, I must have been quite a kid. When I got married and went on my honeymoon, I took the dog with me. I told the hotel clerk that I wanted a room for my wife and me and a special room for Sex. He said that every place and every room in their place was for Sex. I said, you don't understand. Sex keeps me awake at night. The clerk said it kept him awake at night, too. One day I entered Sex in a contest. Before the competition, the dog ran away. Another contestant asked why I was just standing there looking around. I haven't done this often enough. I told him I wanted to have Sex in the contest. He said I should have sold tickets. But you don't understand, I said. I had hopes of having Sex on TV. He called me a pervert. When my wife and I separated, we went to court to fight for custody of the dog. I said, Your Honor, I had Sex before we were married. The judge said he did too. And I told him that after I was married, Sex left me. He said, me too. Last night, I had got Sex back. Sex ran off again. I spent hours looking around town for him. A cop came over to me and asked, What are you doing in this alley at 4 a.m.? I said I was looking for Sex. My case comes up on Friday. This very, 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 very rich lady can only honestly be called a rich bitch. And this very poor lady are both in the post-delivery room. It's the second child for the rich lady, the first for the poor child, for the poor lady. The rich lady looks over and says, This is my second child. After our first, my husband was so happy, he ran right out and bought me a 6-carat diamond. The poor woman looked over and she says, That's nice. And that wasn't enough. He went out immediately and bought me a full-length mink coat. That's nice. Through a sonogram, we've learned that this child was going to be a boy, so he's promised as soon as I get home from the hospital, we go out and he buys me a brand new powder blue Mercedes. That's nice. Well, hasn't your husband done anything for you? As a matter of fact, he has. As soon as I became pregnant, he went right out, he stopped eating lunch, and he started saving his money. And he arranged to have me sent to finishing school so I could be a fit mother for our child. Did they teach you anything in finishing school? Yeah. They taught me instead of saying, screw you, to say, that's nice. In NA, that joke becomes even a little bit more vulgar. There's a new secretary at this office, and Penny Prissy, and she gets a call from a collection agency asking, Do you have a sex hour there? And she says, Hell no, we don't even have a coffee break. Got to think that one through a little bit. Anyhow, this is a very difficult topic for me, talking about how we are precious sexually. It's the opposite of the difficulties I've had with intellectual. I told you intellectual, I realized that so many people had their mind put down all the time, and my mind was never put down, my doing was. So I couldn't fully identify. In this area, I have a lot of problems because I still carry very, very, very much of the emotional baggage, and I feel less precious in the sexual area than I do in any other. As I shared with you briefly, and I'll add a little bit more on to that, I was abused sexually. Pia Melody's tapes helped me become aware of this. I know that I was certainly scarred. Prior to listening to her tapes, I would have been flabbergasted if you even wondered if I had been abused sexually, not with my mother's rigid standards. But Pia helped me share, and I want to repeat this, anything that strips you or me, anything that strips us from an experience of being a precious child and a major area of our lives is abusive. Whether it's done directly or indirectly, done by openly molesting or as my mother did it, by making me feel cheap, dirty, and sinful for what I was, or by helping me pick up those attitudes. And as I shared with you, I'm not blaming her. It just helps me understand where this happened, and I know it was passed on to her. Pia Melody has this very sad phrase from me, and the beat goes on. You know, it happened to my mother, and the beat goes on. It happens to me, and I've been a parent, and I don't go for counseling, and I don't work through it. The beat goes on. It goes on to the next generation. Abused children become abusing parents because they can only identify with the abuse. I want to talk. I don't want to forget this. From reading, it may have been a little bit of Bradshaw on someone else, I got my first real understandings as to how the good that is done by certain people doing actions sexually that they hate for themselves, like sometimes molesting children or flashing children. I've really come to see from my own life and from one of my best friends how sex is a total, total addiction. I have a friend who's A-A-N-A, I think he did coke, Al-Anon, and he's in SAA, and he has 2.5 years, at least, maybe 3 years clean now. But he flashes children, and he was a father of a 2-year-old daughter, and I don't think you could find a more loving father. He had such a respect for his own child. And seeing that and knowing that, and then hearing how when the addiction, when the compulsion hits, he's absolutely powerless. There's nothing he can do. I really understood in his life, in my life, and the life of many other people how absolutely powerless people, truly sexually addicted people are, can be in this area. And then I would wonder, well, what good would come from it? You have to walk through it to feel it. But you see, the root of codependency is, when you take it the next step, if you're shame-based. I am shame-based, which means I'm flawed inside. I am wrong. Harmful as it may seem, it is easier to dislike myself for something I do. It distracts me from what I am. This is one step less painful than this. And so, for example, in flashing a child, he could look at himself, and I guarantee you he hated himself, but he could hate himself for what he did and wouldn't have to go to that next more painful state and come inside and hate himself for what he was. Now, he went into codependent therapy and that and SAA, which is Sexaholics Anonymous. There's several different organizations. That's the one that works so well for him. But it gave me a sort of inkling in this. My mother's basic attitude that I told you about when she saw that I'd had a wet dream and how she reacted to it, my mother's attitude has stayed all through her life. That's just sort of a symptom. It's funny in its own way, but if I were home today, where it was the summer and there were two flies on the screen, one on top of another. My mother goes crazy getting a fly squatter to squash them because they're doing dirty. You know, God forbid that she had ever seen two dogs doing anything. I don't know that she could handle it in her whole experience. And she conveys then this whole feeling that this is all dirty. And unfortunately, I had Polish nuns. I mean literally Polish nuns, born in Poland, came to the United States teaching me in my grammar school. And we got all the horror things. It was like if you went to kiss a cousin, you pulled a watch out. And if you held the kiss for over 10 seconds, you'd go to hell for all eternity, because over 10 seconds wasn't a cousinly kiss. It was passionate, and that was mortally sinful, and God would put you in hell. I'm sure many of you have heard the phrase, how bad this is, because many people were introduced to the same thing. Sex is so dirty, sex is so evil that if you do it, it doesn't admit of any degrees. Anything done in the sexual area is a mortal sin, and you're going to go to hell for it. So sex is dirty, so save it for the person you love in marriage. Doesn't quite compute, I mean, but it's exactly what had been said. I have a lot of troubles, Dad, and I'm sure many of you do. I'm sure most of you do in almost any area, seeing ourselves as precious sexually. And as always, I want to look at some of the obstacles. And first is the attitude of the Western churches, Western Christianity. It is so important to read the Bible and see what it says. I think if you could blank out anything you had ever heard and pick the Bible up and read it cover to cover, and then you heard almost any priest, nun, or minister talking today, you would wonder, where do they get it from? See, we go to the Bible with what we've heard, and we find in the Bible what isn't there, and we exaggerate what is there. In the Bible, sex is an exceptionally small part of the Bible. Exceptionally small. It is impossible to picture the proportion of talking we get in religion when you look at how little it's mentioned there. The impression you would get if you spend time, I don't know if it's as bad in some of the more modern churches like the Catholic Church since Vatican II, but certainly if you went into the pre-Vatican Church, the impression you would get is Jesus came and he said, a new commandment I give you, be chaste. And that's all there is to it. And that isn't what he said at all. Very, 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 such a small percent. Definitely not spotlighted. The example I can use to show how people take things out of context, and it can feel like with being gay in a sense, you hear so many people talk about whatever it is that you said that no gay person is going to inherit the kingship. That's an interesting sentence, because in whatever document it is, whatever letter it is, it's about this line, the verse, and it has a list of about 9 things, 2 or 3 of them sexual, and about 5 or 6 of them not, and the last one is backbiting, talking about somebody behind their back. And they are all equal on one big line, and it says none of these will inherit the kingship. But when you hear people get up and they denounce being gay, you'll never hear that. You'll never hear them say being gay is as bad as talking about somebody behind their back, and if you've ever done that, you're not going to inherit the kingship. People approach the Bible with a particular bent. They go looking for the sexual things. They focus in, they pull them out, and they exaggerate them completely. It isn't just the Old Testament. The New Testament has very, 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 very little on sex. Jesus' whole attitude was to bring all of God's children together and love each other in a loving community. His whole accent is love each other and don't hurt each other. And certainly there are things we can do sexually that hurt each other, and he didn't want us to do that. There are things we can do physically. There are things we can do in other ways. And he was equally telling us not to do that. Why is sex so spotlighted in Western culture? You know, it certainly isn't in all cultures. I grew up in a coal mining town in Pennsylvania, and we were too poor to afford any blacks into our town, so I was raised without any bigotry against blacks. But almost everybody needs to have somebody to look down on. From Jesus Was a Capricorn, Chris Christopherson's album. Everybody needs somebody to look down on. So I was raised with a tremendous bigotry passed on from my mother against Jewish people. They were the only people we could hate, save for us. Until I, in my sophomore year in high school, got a job at the Jewish Community Center. And they were, and they are, the best employees I ever had in my life. I ran the game room, and I was asked to work at their summer camp. I worked 1 year at the summer camp. The next year, I was asked to head the camp, and it was interesting. The two people who were counselors of the camp, me and a teacher, both were non-Jewish, and every counselor we had underneath us was Jewish. Every year I worked for them, I got a Christmas present. I did not get a Hanukkah present. I did not get a holiday present. I got a present because you exchanged presents on this holy day for you, so we're giving you a present. I was called in by my priest because in this little Polish community that I lived in, he wanted to know, in a town that is over half Catholic, and that's like about 3% Jewish, didn't I think I could find at least one Jewish girl to date? It was kind of upset, but it kind of washed away my bigotries. But let me tell you, at that time, certainly, the Jewish people did not have our hang-ups on sex. They had an exceptionally healthy attitude toward the entire approach that sex is part of being a person. It is not all of religion. It is part of religion, and it fits into its part. It's down here. It isn't up here. It's not the big thing. It's almost like if you blew it all out of proportion, made me all ear, one big ear. Put it in its proportion to see where it belongs. I put it in here because it's so funny in quotes. Primitive cultures have very healthy attitudes toward sex. Very, very, very healthy. It's civilization, Western civilization, that's so sick and that's so titillating and that hides it and that laughs about it and that has so many hang-ups. There, I'm positive, are far, far less repression, needs to repress sexual feelings in many, many primitive cultures than there are in Western civilization. My reason, I think, why sex is blown out of proportion is because for 1,000 years we have had a celibate priesthood in the Catholic Church. And celibate nuns. Some of them chose to be by this, and some of them could do it very, very easily. Others were put in a profession. They wanted the profession, and they took the celibacy as sort of a baggage that was part of the rules of the game. And you know, some of us here, as you know, are compulsive overeaters. The one thing a compulsive overeater who is dieting fetishes upon is food. Now, when you take a normal person and cut off a normal function, what they're going to fetish upon is that function. And it's not that a celibate clergy sees sex in its right perspective, because they're not having it. They magnify it and make it everything. Somewhere they came up with the rule that sex is the only area that doesn't admit of degrees, and anything done sexual is instantly a mortal sin. There isn't a hint of that anywhere in the Bible. I would say the basic root of that is that a celibate clergy certainly knows of no degrees in its frustration in this area. So because we have had so many people who were in no way doing anything in the sexual area, they became focused upon it and they blew it way out of proportion and they magnified, they were hypnotized by it and made this religion. And Jesus very, very definitely didn't at all. When I taught in high school, did something rather dramatic. In some ways, I was a good teacher. I think, as I told you, I had to get fired because I fought the authority, but I, in some ways, functioned very well. I was already sober and had a loving God. And the second day of class, I would pass a sheet, and I didn't pass. I always say it that way, and it's a lie. I'd tell every kid to get a sheet out, and I'd say, okay, now, the next 5 minutes, I want you to write all the things on this sheet of paper that if you were God and your mother did these things, you want her to hurt in hell forever. And I would just go over to a desk and sit down and watch the kids stare. Somebody would give me the Ten Commandments, and I know that there's a terminal codependent who's only going to say what you want, and I'm not going to reach that kid all year. And you couldn't. Only parrot back. One or two kids would write one or two things. Maybe some gal had been raped or someone close to her had been molested, and they've come up with something this bad that if somebody did this, I want them to hurt. Most kids would sit there with a blank paper. And this is what I would tell them. You won't write anything because you love your mama. You don't want her to hurt. And then we tell you God is perfect love, and then we give you a whole list of things that if she does these, God's going to put her in hell forever. Something doesn't compute. Anytime you end up being more loving and human than God, something's wrong with your religion. Go back to the basics and wrestle with it. Go back and wrestle. I'm not going to give you any answers. Anytime you're more loving and kind and gentle than God, something is wrong. And go back and go through it all. I believe that our obsession with sex was found in that Neoplatonic thought I told you all about. A handy little reference. Matter is evil. What distracts you from God is dangerous. Augustine's statement that only children validate sex, marriage, and women. Pope St. Gregory the Great said he could not possibly picture how a married couple would not sin having intercourse. Now, his statement is a sign of maturity, silly, as stupid as it sounds. Because, now see, you're not supposed to enjoy it. If you enjoy it, that'll distract you from God. You're just supposed to be doing this so you can have a child. And he was realistic enough to know that almost no married couple could have this intercourse without slipping somewhere and enjoying it. And that joy, in his view, was wrong. I mean, that's this, and that's not, you know, that's philosophy. That's not theology. He's coming up with this thought that pleasure, that joy is wrong. Incidentally, that's my understanding of how you get in this whole Protestant stream of the drinking's wrong, smoking's wrong, and dancing's wrong, and gambling's wrong. Bodily pleasures are wrong. We've never had that in the Catholic Church. If you don't know it, the third commandment was not given for God in our Catholic. It's remember, man, keep the Sabbath holy. It doesn't say go to the temple or go to church or anything. That's not the command. You know what basically the third command really means, as scripture scholars are sure it was given? Go play. Take a day off every week and play. Enjoy my universe. Smell the roses. Do what God did. What did God do on the seventh day? He rested from his work. God didn't pray to himself. He didn't get schizophrenic and talk to himself. God rested from his work. He made the day holy, and he says, you do the same thing. Take a day and smell the roses. Play. Learn to relax. Now and it's sometimes good reason to say, if you're really going to play, you got to know you have some love, so it's good on a Sunday to go to church. That's not the command, though. The command is God saying, I know how you're made, and if you don't play, you're going to hurt. So keep the Sabbath holy. Do what I did. It's not don't do anything. It's rest from your work. Why? So you can enjoy the universe. Someone working 7 days could never smell the roses. Smell the roses. Bake some cookies, if you're a man. Grease a car, if you're a lady. I can't. I don't know where the heck it goes. But, so, our culture has made it all what our God didn't. It's made it all so strong. And then, with all of this happening, we have such strong repressions. Because we have so many hang-ups passed down to us. This is wrong, that's wrong. This is a mortal sin, don't do this. Cover yourself all the way up, be so prudish, then we're repressing. And Freud just basically made repression sex because of all the accents we're putting on it. And then that just puts a bigger accent on the whole thing. So it's harder for us to see ourselves as precious because there's so many things in the area of sex that have been repressed. I don't know where it is. I was supposed to have shared it, I guess. Now it'll come up in a while. Another big area that I have problems with here. This is further complicated by our society, American society, offering us a healthy introduction to sex. Years ago, people lived in one room. The parents went behind a screen sometimes, but the children knew what they were doing. And they knew they were doing what the animals were doing. And it wasn't titillating, and it wasn't silly. It was just a normal part of life, what the animals were doing and what the parents were doing. And children learned they did it too. That isn't done today. I hope one person here, at least, had their parents sit down right through an early age and tell them their sex drives were precious and good and healthy, and that, you know, not that they were going to go blind or anything else like this. You know, just can I do it just until I need glasses? I heard a cute AA speaker say that once. His mother had said this, and you gave him all the warnings, and it's at the start of his talk, and he was going on like this, and he just said, you know how she said, you keep doing that, you're going to go blind, and he said, so I asked her if I could just keep doing it till I wore glasses, and at that time, you didn't know he had them. He picked his glasses up and put them on, and everybody just went, kind of nice. I mean, just, most of us learn whatever we do in the gutter. I didn't even learn it there. I never learned it. See, I was 5, and everybody else was 6. And I was like 10 and they were 11. I was 11 and they were 12. And they were going through things that I didn't even know happened. I couldn't dream about, didn't know anything about this because, well, you just don't talk in our family. We had the absolute rule of non-communication. Never, one talk with my dad when he told me why I went to college. Never talked feelings with him. I've never had a talk with my mother in my whole life. Saddest thing, she had a stroke, and about 3 years later I was home, and I wasn't sure I'd ever see her again. She was in her middle 70s. She could have another stroke. I had 20 minutes before going to the airport, and we were alone, and all she talked about was how she hated cockroaches. And I was like, I was here, and I went up there, and I looked at the conversation, and it was, isn't it sad we can't talk? We're making words so we don't have to share. We've never shared anything. We certainly have never shared in the area of sex. She could not do that. This is why I told you that it's so important that we use the right terms with ourselves. That guys don't call their penis a dick. That's cheap. And see, if I use a cheap word, then I'm cheap. Women don't call their vagina a cunt or boobs. It's very important you use the right words. And if outside of a joking area, you even insist in some ways that the right words be used, because I can't use a cheap term and experience a value of precious at the same time. I must use a good word if I'm to know how really precious I am. So we have all these problems, and it's further complicated, as I shared with you, by the epidemic of molesting that we've had in our particular backgrounds, in alcoholic homes, in codependent homes, in ACA homes. I gave you that statistic that just blew my mind. 60% at least of the gals in alcoholic homes are molested as children. Like the national statistics I'm seeing are just so much higher than we ever dreamed. The great number of women who are raped. I just heard the statistic of women who are raped in big cities. I couldn't believe it. I forgot what it was. It was like almost 1 in 3, I think. It's that high. And if you live in one of the million plus cities, couldn't dream. I mean, you come out of Sterling, Oklahoma. That's unbelievable. So there's so much that is done to strip us of our experience of being precious. In my therapy, I went to my therapist once and I said, you know, driving up here, I had just this flash that my mother, and it's no memory, I said, clearly not, but it was just like a thought that my sister was born like 20 months after me. And being human, you would know that very likely I got jealous. And my mother's nursing my sister. I wanted to be nursed. And my mother took me and put my head between her breasts and smothered me in shame. And ever since then, I know I have a very deep aversion to women's breasts. And I didn't know why. And my therapist said, you can never create a memory like that. So it has to have a root going somewhere. And it would fit totally my mother's personality. When she blew up and was angry and impatient, she will use shame as the great, or like shame this kind, as the great technique. That's another form. That's an active form, though I do feel now I was even actively molested. And all of these, we have all this baggage that we carry within us. Almost none of us had good modeling from our parents, because they didn't know. They weren't modeled themselves. But like, if your mother felt less as a woman, then she couldn't model healthy womanhood for you. In my case, I'm sure my mother has a deep inner psychological dislike for men. And she tied this with the fact that my dad wanted only 3 children and started practicing birth control. And at that time, the church said, if you practice birth control, you're going to go to hell forever. And she thought, she identified, and it just helped her. The church helped her see religion as a sin. So it brought in all of her guilt. She could feel that guilt in bed. One of the neatest moments of her life was when she had a hysterectomy. And I mean that. She was a different. She was so happy after she had her hysterectomy because she didn't have to do dirt. In my term, though, I mean, because that's one of the things she did tell me, one of the few things I really remember her sharing. So if she has, like, she has no respect for men, she's communicating that. And my sister will have trouble respecting men, and I will have trouble respecting myself as a man. If the dad is a macho man who has no respect for women, then, and you're a woman raised in a home like that, first you have to have a fear and an anger, and you have a feeling of being lesser. And the sons raised in homes like that have trouble respecting women and treating them as women. All of these things are communicated to us, and it's so difficult for us to really know that we're precious. So it's important that we turn it around and see that a loving God, wants me to see that I'm precious sexually. Sex is not dirty. It's not a shameful part of me to be hidden. It's a central part of who I am to be appreciated and to be respected, to be revered, to be venerated. It's holy. Sex is holy. And we truly have to understand that. Go back to what I started, that at the first day, on the sixth day, when God paused and he looked at his universe and he pronounced it very good. And that included Adam and Eve in their full sexual fullness. Adam and Eve felt comfortable in their nakedness until they sinned. It's sin, and sin is, if God is love, sin is a lack of love. It's a lack of love that makes us ashamed of anything we are sexually. And if any of us could be fully and totally healthy sexually, fully, wholly, filled with love, we'd be able to embrace everything we are. And in a symbolic, I don't mean an actual way because society couldn't take it, but in a symbolic way, stand absolutely naked before the world. I would need to hide no part of me. I would know that God is loving all that I am, and I can be all that I am. Let me, in this point, make a few comments on one other problem you might still have, and that is the great respect that Christianity has for virginity. First, that's not in the Old Testament. The Old Testament took very seriously the phrase in the first book of the Bible. God said, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The Old Testament felt that God put upon his people a religious duty to have children. So the Old Testament saw virginity as a violation of a command of God. And they saw not having children as a curse from God. So there's no respect for virginity in the Old Testament. There's one or two hints when the Greek wisdom comes in, but not in the Hebrew books. We like virginity first because of the Virgin Mary. We respect it. But let me tell you what it teaches. Mary's virginity in her birth teaches us something very beautiful. What it means is that God's presence in our life, in our sobriety, in our programs, in our church, in our hearts, is not the result of anything we do. The love of God was not in Mary because of what Mary and Joseph did. The love of God was only in Mary solely because of what God did. Therefore, our failure to perform right will not strip us of the presence of God in our midst. If our meeting is poor, if our church is poor, if my prayers are poor, I don't lose God's love because God is virginally present in us. The virginity of Mary after the birth of Jesus is a little bit more difficult to describe. Normally, we need human love to come to divine love. And that's the normal way it always has to be. We need to know the love of someone else. And when we know that love, we can step back and say, wow, God is infinitely this. And for most people, having human love is just so helpful. I certainly could never have known God if I hadn't known alcoholics truly humanly loving me. One family was different. They had absolute perfect love in their family, Mary and Joseph. For them to have human love could have been a distraction from the more perfect love that they had here. And it wouldn't have been more for them, it would have been less. And so human sex could have been unnecessary for them. The teaching of that is that in the love that we're given by God, we truly do have everything we need. Now, we don't have Jesus physically present in our family, so we need human love to come to know God's love. But then we can turn it around and use the virginity of Mary to come to understand that what the church has, what the program has, the God that is there handles every need that we have when we're open to it. Now, that's not the problem, the virginity of Mary. The problem comes from Paul. Paul's writing clearly says, hey, you know, if you're married, stay married. If you're not married, don't get married. Stay a virgin. Let me tell you why Paul wrote what he wrote. Paul literally expected Jesus to come back next week or next month when he writes this letter. It's going to happen. He clearly did not, when these letters are written, he clearly did not expect to die before Jesus returned. So if it ain't going to be next month, it's going to be next year. Now, the greatest event in the universe is going to happen. Jesus is going to return. It's like he's going to freeze everything. And if you're open to his love, you walk into his love. And they didn't know then what would happen to others. Okay? So Paul is very practical. And he says, hey, if you're single and you start getting involved with marriage plans and Jesus is coming back here, you might miss him. Don't put the good before the best. That's one instance when I was asked that question, when the good would be an enemy of the best. Because the best is about to be sealed forever. Paul was also very practical. I'm going to make it in blunter terms, but it's in the Bible. He says, but if you're that horny that all you're thinking about is sex, well, for heaven's sake, get married. Because the horniness will distract you till you get this out of your system and then can turn to God. He's not saying virginity is better. And his premise was wrong. Clearly, Jesus didn't return in his lifetime. So everything he predicates that statement on was wrong, the imminent return of Jesus. And he wasn't coming down with theology, he was coming down with practical advice, and it is true. You know, if you knew Jesus was coming back tomorrow, why would you work today? Why pay taxes today? It changes everything. Put your focus on that, don't be disturbed, and just be ready for it. But when you change and you say that isn't going to be the case, then you have a whole different set of circumstances. So Christianity has put off a value on virginity that has made a lot of us think that sex is cheap. It isn't. Virginity is golden and it has its message for those who can grow well with it. But sex is equally beautiful as an expression. Sex is sacred. It's a God creation. It allows... I just saw this in writing for you, how what is really so wonderful about sexual intercourse. It allows such a full union. If you took ideals of two people, it is, you have an exceptionally intense body pleasure. Body, then come down to the emotions. And when there's real love, like puppy love, an exceptionally intense feeling of love, and then if you go to what intellectual love is, a real desire to make the other person happy. If you really can do this, you can bring in an exceptionally great intellectual desire to serve. It can bring about, when it is ideally done, the greatest unity of one whole person on those three levels, body, emotions, and mind. And then have that same unity with another person. How total it is, how wonderful it is, how sacred it is. God made his people to be together. That'll be the big thing we're going to talk about next talk. In sexual unity, this really, we get a view of what the whole universe is supposed to be. And I think it displays the unity God intends for us to have. So I need to accept myself as sexual. First as male, female. And some of us have problems right there. I don't know when I was first told that I'm the second child. The first was a boy. The room was all pink. So I'm a disappointment. You know, I'm not supposed to be me. I'm supposed to be a girl. I don't know how many of you were supposed to be boys. That's much stronger even, unfortunately, for women because of the put-down in society for women still. And so we get a feeling in here that male is not right for me. Female is not right for me. So the beginning of being sexual comes with trying to claim my maleness. Very healthy work, many people say, is to stand in front of a mirror naked until you can love yourself in front of a mirror naked and accept your sexuality. I need, one sex is not better than another. I'm gentle with my people. I don't believe in springing surprises. So 3 summers ago, I warned them, in case it would be too strong for them, didn't upset anybody. They loved it, I think, that next week the sermon will be God. She is also mother. And it has to be. You know, if we're told, in the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he made them. In the divine image, he made them. Then God must be as much mother as father. And the early fathers of the church say, well, we've never heard, that the use of the term father for God never was intended to hint at masculinity, but rather as ultimate source, as parent. It's an analogy, not an expression of masculinity, as unfortunately people have taken it. So I have to see myself first as male and female, male or female. I want to share my understanding. I have a unique understanding of what it means to be male and what it means to be female. We're both supposed to have both. You know, and we're all supposed to have both within us. And mine is different from anybody else's. And basically, I see being masculine as like implanting the seed. Being feminine as taking seed and bringing it to life. So when I look at my male and my female role, being masculine for me means knowing that I have goodness in me, that there is love, that I have something to give to you to put more life in you. Being feminine for me means I also know that I have the ability to sit and draw forth love from you, to invite you to be fully giving in this sense, and offer that love to me and bless me with that love so we can have a flow. And of course, you see some people who can only give and can't take. And that can't make a healthy relationship. Or some who can only take love and never feel they have to give. They're unaware of that part. That doesn't make for a healthy relationship. To be fully healthy in this sense, I think we all need, and according to the understanding I have of this, to try to get as balanced as we can in our understanding of being male, goodness to give, female, the ability to call forth goodness and receive it and accept it and be blessed by it, so that the whole circle of love can be happened. I hope that my sharing of that won't offend anybody's femlib or male chauvinism views. If it does, tough. I got peace with myself. I got to see myself as sexual male or sexual female too. Normal, natural, healthy to have sex. Erections are normal. They are very, very normal. It is not normal for a person not to have an erection. As I told you, it's important to really believe that Jesus had them, that Jesus experienced sexual urges and went through then the body changes that go along with these. Otherwise, he wasn't fully human. I should then next, so I see myself as male, sexual male, and then as functioning sexual male. I should see this as something pleasing to God. I wonder if any of you can really believe that God is far more pleased sometimes with sexual intercourse than with prayer. If people are happy, if they're escaping loneliness, if they're finding each other, if they're not hurting each other, what would a loving parent want? What makes you most happy, the joy of your children? And if a father's like looking down on so many of us and sees the loneliness the codependents have, and two people can find each other in intercourse and just escape that loneliness and find some acceptance, I don't see how going to church and saying a rosary can make God happier than that. I really don't. See, we have a very sick understanding of God, too. Carry through your conclusions. Supposing I were to tell you, my mother's going to have serious surgery tomorrow. Would you please do something for her? How many of you would say, good, I'll go to the kitchen and ask if they'll give me an extra piece of pie? So God will get her through the surgery. That isn't our way. I'll give it up. Tell you what I'll do. I'll give up dessert. Carry that through. Watch what this says. I'll give it up because God will be happy when I'm miserable. God is more likely to listen to me when I'm miserable. What's heaven going to be like then? Might be a lot more fun in hell. Having a piece of pie, making myself happy, makes God happy. Now, there is a reason to say no. There's a reason, a very important reason for fasting. All you got to look is the average alcoholic. You know, we're people, I want what I want before I want it. Rome may not have been built in a day, but that's only because I didn't build it. And if I were the builder, it would have been built yesterday. That's my whole attitude. If one is good, three is better. I'm not even a two man. I jump right to three. It's a Trinity number, so you can make it kind of religious. I'll overdo everything. Now, when I'm just satiating me, glutton me, but if I have an urge, I'm going to take care of it. It's impossible for me to listen to you. To listen to you, I must be able to say no to me. And fasting is training in saying no to what my body wants so I can say yes in love to give it to you. It's not making God happy by making me miserable. It's trying to teach me that my deepest happiness will come from my ability to love you, and I cannot have that ability to love you if all I'm doing is taking care of myself. That's a different kind of thing. But we have to see that it's our joys that would please God, not our miseries. And how much God has to be pleased with some intercourse. He certainly can't with others when people are being hurt. It's very important for me to see Jesus fully accepting me in these roles. One of my big breakthroughs was in a meditation first, and I'm going to say the first one, and I hope the second won't offend you, because it was done in a very tasteful way, but to have me just, I was in bed entirely naked, and Jesus came in the room and appreciated who and what I am. Then Mary came in the room and did the same. And that helped me in a big way to accept myself as sexual. I don't want to have to excuse it. If I'm offending you, I'm sorry, because to me it's a very religious thing. There's nothing sexual in this. It's I'm bringing it in and seeing myself as I am. Experiencing God wanting me to be male. God wants you to be female. God wants you to be a sexual female. And God wants you to be a functioning sexual female. We'll take our break now, okay? Come. I want to deal with two or three areas that need some particular explanation. I heard it even talked about a little bit on the side. Jesus saying that lust was wrong, and lusting in the heart, and was as bad as acting outside. I want to share a little bit about this to help you in both of these ideas that I'm going to talk about, maybe coming to an easier grasp of how our God does relate with us. I think it's always important to go back and understand that our God loves us, and our God wants us to know that love, and our God wants us to live in a community of love. And because of this, Jesus, basically like the Ten Commandments, were a negative guide. If I do certain things to you, our relationship with each other is broken and we can't live in harmony. If I'm stealing from you, if I'm abusing you, if I'm lying against you, if society isn't based on truth, there can't really be a society. But Jesus came and he gave us a very simple standard. And it's love. Love equals what helps us. Hurt, evil is what hurts us. And if we apply this, we can easily get a better understanding of all the rules. So many of us, because we're Anglo-Saxon, see the commands as rules out here. And God is somebody who's just going to see if we break the command, and the command's arbitrary. You know, you come up to a stop sign, you're in the middle of a desert, and you can see for 100 miles, and there's no car there. You pull out without stopping, you get a ticket. If there's they have to see you, but if you're flying around up there. You know, it doesn't, our laws don't take circumstances into consideration. And that's how we see God's laws, as Anglo-Saxon rules. They're not made that way. Church laws aren't made that way, by any chance. Church laws come out of an Italian culture, a very, very different culture, a whole different way of understanding everything. The commandments should best be seen, I think, as menus given by a dietitian. If you were diabetic and there'd never been diabetes in your family, and you come to me for help, and I'm a dietitian in a hospital, I'd give you a menu, and I'd say, look, here's the do the do's and don't the don'ts, and you'll feel healthier than you've ever been before. So for 6 or 8 months, you like that. You go out and you do the do's and you don't the don'ts. And you're healthy and you're happy, but you've got this hidden passion for banana splits. And you've fought it for 8 months and you go crazy and you eat 8 banana splits and you go into a coma. I have not punished you with the coma at all. You know, you have eaten an unhealthy menu and your body suffers. And if you understand that and apply it to all religious rules, I think you'll understand, I think, how God relates with us. God made us. And he knows what we need to eat spiritually to be healthy, to be fully whole. And he knows what is bad for us. And he says, do the do's, and you'll be healthier than ever, and don't the don'ts. Now, we can get too legalistic, so he gave us this one simple little rule. Watch what hurts you. I honestly do believe that sin is immediately its own punishment. That if I hurt you, if I abuse you, if I'm not respecting you as a person, I can't respect myself as a person. And I pay an immediate price. I pay it from the loss of personal relationships, and I'll pay it from the loss of interpersonal respect for me and love. And it always, always happens. If a command keeps me from loving, from growing as a person, it instantly ceases to apply. Any of the commands, church or God, if they keep us from knowing love or from giving love that we're supposed to, the command doesn't apply. That's not new. That's not new theology. That's basic in our thinking. The best example, because we were taught it in the seminary and I saw it come true. If a father is doing everything he can to feed his children and they're likely to starve to death, he has a duty to steal, in Catholic theology, what he can to feed his children. Their right to life comes before somebody else's right to property at that particular moment. If he has done everything he can. I saw this applied in its most horrid. This was unbelievable. A man in Baltimore had 3, 4, or 5 young children. Real young, like maybe none of them under third grade. And he had been laid off from a job, and he had 2 weeks to wait to get a check. He had gone out and found temporary work, and he had 1 week to wait for a check from that one. He went to Catholic Charities, the Salvation Army, and Welfare, and they all three had him fill out forms and told him to come back in a week and they'd have money for him if it validated. In the meantime, there wasn't a drop of milk in the refrigerator. He got a gun, got into a cab, and held the gun on the cabbie, and this will date this thing. He robbed him of 50 cents and told him, drive me to a dairy store. I need milk for my child, and that's all. When he was in the dairy store, the cabbie called the police. This is one of the most horrid violations of justice I've ever heard in my life. Thank God it made the papers. Because the prosecution agreed to every fact I'm telling you. The man had never been arrested in his life. 50 cents for a quart of milk for his kids. Never arrested. Of course, the gun makes it a felony instantly, armed robbery. The judge gave him 15 years. Because it made the paper, they totally reversed the whole thing. But I mean, you can imagine that heartless judge. Now, in Catholic theology, that father had a duty to do what he did. A duty to do it. It was not only not a sin, it would have been a sin to let the kid starve. So any time a commandment keeps us from loving, it doesn't apply. That's why this command of helping and hurting is so good in dealing with real people. And you could take this standard and use it on lust. When is lust wrong? It isn't the urge that's wrong. What is wrong with lust? If I see someone, they're attractive sexually, and I take that person, and I just think about it, and think about it, and think about it, and think about it. I'm taking a person and making them an object so I can have sexual pleasure. And that hurts me. See, the command is not in there that lusting about you somehow hurts you. You don't know about it. So how do you know I'm lusting over you? It can't harm you. It does and can harm me. And because God loves me, God says, no, you don't need this. You don't need this at all. Don't do this to yourself. If you use another person as a thing, you make yourself a thing. And you cheapen yourself. So that's what's wrong with the lusting. It's not that the lusting is equal to the intercourse. In that sense, although, if it's adultery, what adultery is, it's using another person also as a thing. And in the same way, I'm hurting myself. So what basically Jesus is saying, whether I act on it or not, just like with the anger, whether I kill you or not, if I'm filled with hate, I can't know love. Whether I act on it or not, if I'm using you as a thing, I'm using you as a thing, and I experience the same side effects. Imagine if any one of us here could see all of us as how precious we are. What a wonderful person. If I saw you as a living tabernacle, if I saw you with such dignity, because you got the Spirit of God, that I ought to kneel in front of you. If you're Catholic, we genuflect when we come into church because we believe God's presence is there. But the same God fully inhabits every person. We ought to genuflect in front of everybody else. If I saw you with that dignity, I'd have to know I have it. And if I don't see you have it, then I don't know I have it. And that's what I believe is being shared here. I want to apply the same thing to another area, and I've talked about it several times. See, there's so many sexual fetishes. I have done an outline on the fourth step, and it's kind of notorious in places. I think it is circulating in this area. It has about 30 pages of specific questions, and there's 4 or 5 pages of specific questions on sex. Like, did you ever have intercourse with a chicken? Everyone on there, someone has come to me with a fifth step and done. And the questions are there because they were important to someone. And I was at a meeting once, and somebody was mocking it, and mocking the step, and I was in a good place. You didn't know I was there. I didn't know who did the inventory or anything. I said, I'm the guy who did that, and I want to tell you a few things. Those questions are on there because they're important. And if you're mocking it, and somebody is sitting over here, and they've done it, you're making them feel cheap. And people don't come to meetings to be felt cheap, to be made cheap. I will probably get to say it nowhere else, but... And it fits in here because we're talking about love and being concerned with others. One of the saddest phrases, especially in Alcoholics Anonymous, is, at least I never, or thank God I never. any time I've ever heard that used, a friend of mine or me has been in the audience and I've known they've done it. And if I stand up here and I say, well, at least I never parted my hair on the left side, and you just parted your hair on the left side, how have I made you feel? Or thank God, you know, I've never, and you've just done it, or you did do it. There's a real insensitivity when we deal with each other's like that. And we have to be sensitive to the needs of others. And I may not have done it. One of the neatest things I've ever heard was by a gal named Alabam. She came into the program, and she was very rich. She had no use for prostitutes. She played around a lot in her drinking, but she had no use for prostitutes. Couldn't see, identify with that at all. Till one day, finally, it hit her right here. The only difference between her and a prostitute was she didn't need the money. I heard her say that, and it's the only thing I needed to hear. When I hear one phrase in a talk, I'll flush out everything else so I don't forget it. And that's been so important. The only difference I have ever found between me and you in any respect is I didn't need the money, whatever we're talking about. If I didn't do it, it's because I wasn't there. I broke every rule I had, and I can't judge you, therefore. And if I'm going to start judging you, it's going to come back at me. There's so many areas of sex that I could talk about, but a lot of them are so delicate that I'm just taking the one big one. And you can apply this if you have, as many of us here will, if you have some other little sexual hang-ups, apply it in there to you. I want to talk about homosexuality. Because it is so big and affects so many people, it's a good one to talk about. And there's a major confusion between what a person is and what a person does. And it's a confusion that I have really never seen respected in the statements of almost any church. Action is taken against gays. You hear about this, like the Catholic Church is fighting resolutions that would offer equal rights to gays in San Francisco or in New York, give them certain civil rights. I'm not commenting on the political action at all. But when you hear the statements made, the church is putting down gays. And there's a very big lack of distinction then that says the person is wrong for what they are. Now, I don't know if you know, and this will be true in its foundation for almost any sexual problem, but about one-tenth of our population is gay. And the tenth that is, psychiatrists believe the determination occurs somewhere between the age of 2 and 5. And it flows from things that happen in the relationship between their parents and them. It's nothing that happens, no decision ever made by the child himself. It's an inability to get through the Oedipal complex and transfer from your parent of the same sex to the parent of the other sex in your identification or in your desires. That's a deep thing. That's not important. But it happens between 2 to 5. The kid's not to blame for it. So what you have then is churches condemning one-tenth of the population for what they are in their makeup, something they've had no control over. And if you believe it, that everything stops with God, it's got to have been a decision that God made, that for some reason, this person in the long run can fit best into my plan with an orientation that is basically gay. And we're condemning them for a decision that doesn't flow from them, and it has to flow kind of from God. Pick up the Gospels again. Jesus never condemns the sinner. Now, my understanding of that is there is nothing, nothing that you could do. And this was in a reading we had in the Catholic Church about a month ago, a middle reading, a first reading that people missed. I didn't plan the sermon on it, and I heard it, and I knew I had to tell people a little about codependency, because I've never shared with my people on this, because it was more teaching than preaching. But basically it said, you know, what God hated, he could not have created. If God doesn't like something, he would not have brought it to be. And what God doesn't still continue to like, he would not keep in being. So if there's anything that any of us could ever have done that would cause God not to love us, because God must love. God is love. That's his breathing. God must love. If there's anything that we could do that would cause God not to love us, we couldn't have been created. That's the message, really, that Jesus, I think, brought from about the Father's relating with us. No action can ever strip us of that inner dignity. At the same time that Jesus never condemns the sinner, he never condones the sin. Now, the sin is accepting less love than you need. All sin is just taking the lesser for the better. We need to be filled with total love, and we settle for a lesser love, and there's an emptiness within us. And God loves us so much, He can never say that less is enough, because only the best is good enough for us. And He will never say that. For example, God will never say that homosexual actions are the ideal for society. All you got to do is look at the pain in American society that gay people go through. How they got to hide what they are, how there's so much insecurity, how there's so much rejection, how there's so much fear, how there's so much distrust, how there's so much everything, so much loneliness. I don't know if you know this, there's a basic difference. I don't know any statistic. I don't have statistics. I'm not an expert. I just deal with a lot of people and I have my own views. There's a big difference between male and female gays, and it's a tragic difference. Most women that I know, most lesbians, are able to set up enduring relationships one-on-one with other women to which they are basically loyal. And they last 4, 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Most gays can't do that. For whatever reason, they go from relationship to relationship. Before AIDS, they would want someone different every time. 9 out of 10 women that I'm, who fifth steps I've heard who were gay, were in lasting relationships. I would say it's less than 1 out of 100 men. Maybe 2 out of 100. Somewhere around in there. And I don't understand. I don't have any explanation or anything else. But there's such loneliness. Now, Jesus would not hold this up and say, if you can establish a relationship where society isn't going to hate you and you can have full love, take the lesser and be better. Jesus will never take the lesser, the action, and say that's good enough for you. Sin is something that is not quite fully everything we need, and He'll never say that's enough because we deserve only the best. But if we take the lesser, He'll never say we lose our dignity doing it. He never does that, ever. I taught the kids. If Jesus were alive in St. Louis, fully man today, and He was down wherever your red light district is, and He came up to a prostitute, what would He do? Because there's no doubt about it. The Gospels tell us. He'd say, hey, you know what? Do me 2 favors. I mean, I'm lonely and I'm hungry. Would you go to McDonald's with me? Because I think that's where He'd probably take her. McDonald's or maybe something like Shoney's. Not too much where she wouldn't feel at ease. And He'd take her in there, and while they were eating, all He would do would be to talk. Nothing about her or him. And then he'd thank her, pay for the check, and leave. That's all he would do. Because you see, he's criticized specifically for eating with sinners and prostitutes. Now, if he were telling them off, nobody would criticize him for having the meal. And if they were exes, if they were people who had been prostitutes, nobody would criticize him. If Billy Graham fills a stadium with ex-prostitutes, people will praise him for being with them, not condemn them. So if he's being condemned, 2 things must be true. They got to still be prostitutes, and he's not saying anything. Now, why would he do it? We've all prostituted ourselves, every one of us. I definitely have, for things, some have done things sexually, everything else. We sell ourselves out for so many things. You know what's wrong? Remember, now, laws are not given for the other person. They're given for our good. What's wrong with prostitution? I'm worth the universe. And if I sell myself for some grass as I have, if I sell my dignity for some drinks, for some money, for some favor with the right important people, I'm telling myself that's what I'm worth. And if I tell myself that's what I'm worth, I will believe the lie. Prostitution is the greatest lie, one of the great lies of the universe to the prostitute. Now, when Jesus comes and takes her out to dinner and says, you have value, when he says he has value, one of 2 things has to happen. Either she believes him, and she can't be a prostitute much longer, or she doesn't. See, I've had that happen. It's one of them. I don't normally like sharing successes, because our great thing is we share our pains and our weaknesses. But I went out to Albuquerque, and when I got out there about 3 years ago, a woman asked to see me. We had never met. We met in the bedroom of some friends. I had her background. And she's stunningly beautiful, about 25 to 30 years old, and she asked me to marry her. And I just handled it real nice, just didn't say anything, and very nice, solemn, sacred, quiet. And she says, well, if you won't marry me, can I put you up as a kept man? And that still sounds fascinating to me. I don't know why. There's something about that, you know, just the lure is really there. Again, I didn't say anything. Handled it very well. Now, let me give you the full story. She was a prostitute, 6 months sober, enough class that she gave a guy back $8,000 because she wasn't interested in doing for one night what he wanted. This gal had class. She had heard some tapes of mine, and they made her feel good, and she wanted to say thanks. Now, I'm digging inside. The only language she knew was sexual. She didn't want it to be a handshake and leave. So let's make it last. Sexual marriage lasting. And if you won't do that, because I'm not worth it, then let me give you the next best. Let me continue to say thanks. And I saw the beauty of what she was saying, and I responded to it. And so did everybody else in her own group. And what flowed from that, I just told God later, what flowed from that was within 6 months, she wasn't a prostitute anymore. That's the opposite of the church. See, the church comes in and we denounce the prostitutes. Well, as soon as we denounce the prostitutes, they have no value. That's exactly what they feel, so they can go out and prostitute. How can anybody who has a sense of the dignity of their own life abort? Only people who don't know their dignity can abort. So when we condemn them, we're part of their problem. Jesus wouldn't. The abortion can never be held as the best that a person can do, but the person never loses the dignity. And the solution is not condemning the person, even the act. The solution first, the big solution first. He wouldn't go out and talk to this gal over the hamburger in McDonald's about how bad she was or how bad things are. He just talked positive and love and dignity and beauty and the roses and everything else. Then when people are ready, you let them know that certain actions are not healthy. The same thing is basically true, I think, see, with homosexuality. We come up so he would never ever condemn the gay. Never say the action is right. And there's a gray area. If a person is basically gay in their orientation, cannot have a relationship with a woman, what's the best possible for them? You know, would a loving God want them to live as hermits and isolated and alone and neurotic the rest of their life? Or if two women can get together and find companionship and help each other know love and become healthy, isn't that better than nothing? And we're not talking about the best, we're talking about the best practical for these two people. What would a loving God want? You can have your answers, I can have mine, and they can have theirs. Now, in the area of sex, I have seen very few things more mature than the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It suggests that we examine our conduct in writing, looking for the selfish, the hurting activities that are damaging to others. Then it says when we see this, we seek counsel, advice from others, but not answers. Then it says we get the ultimate answer only from God. We may want to, it doesn't say it in the book, bounce this off a person so we're not confusing ourselves. Now let me tell you why that's so important. In my fifth steps, I've learned a lot. And I would ask a guy, how do you rate yourself sexually? Average, above average, or below average? I call it the horniness factor. You know, in John Wayne America, if a guy thinks he's a wimp, that's a real put-down. And I know that because that's how I felt about myself most of my life, okay? Then I would ask, in your ability to satisfy a woman, how do you rate yourself? Average, above average, or below average? For the same reason. Now, these questions would tell me what the person feels, but they wouldn't give me any index of what I would call their real horniness factor. So that I could get a guess of that, I'd say, you know, at the peak of your activity, somewhere between 18 and 25, on the average, how often would you have anything sexual, masturbation, intercourse, something? I had two men in the same year both tell me they thought they were average sexually. One would have sex twice a year, the other twice a day. Could you see them both thinking, hey, we're both average, we both have the same drives and counseling each other? There's no way I can climb inside you and really know how strong your drives are. Also, to share something my own therapist said with me, sometimes we've got to be very, very careful in talking with people. Because a lot of therapy intends to free the child. She said, the danger of that is your child can run out and do something and your parent could come in with a judgment that your child can't live with. Healthy therapy re-educates the parent so that the parent then will allow the child to become freer. Almost no matter how much I know about you, I can't tell you what your parent will say to your child if your child does certain things. I can't tell you to do things and not do things because I don't know if you can live with it, either which way. What we all need to do, all of us need to work on being precious sexually, and that means honestly looking at ourselves. How do I view my sex, being male, being female? How do I view different activities I have in sex? How do I view my sex? As a part of me Many people, especially those, I think, who have been molested, can see this, their sexual thing as something out here. About all their sexual functions, something dissociated from themselves because they have been so abused. How do I look at my sex organs? How do I look at my sex activities? How do I think God looks at all of these? I hope you're hearing from me that my view is, first, God is looking at you and loving you in your femininity, in your masculinity, and in your confusion. God is loving you as a masculine, functioning, sexual person. For your male, a sexual male, a sexual female. God is loving you, your sex organs. God created them. They're not cheap. They don't have to be hidden from God. God's not uncomfortable with Adam. Adam's uncomfortable with God. And God really looks at the sex activity. You know, if it's the best you can do, it's not upsetting God. If you're hurting someone, God is hurting because you're hurting yourself or someone. It's the best you can do to escape loneliness. I really think a loving God is far more understanding than a lot of clergymen. I would hope that you would pray and meditate to experience yourself as precious sexually. I had a lot of difficulty. I haven't been able to come up with three things I can do to make myself feel precious sexually. That reflects my own problems here. I can be grateful and accept my sex, or ask to be grateful and accept my sex drives. I can try to use sex to love myself and to help other people. What things I can do to make myself feel not precious is to advertise myself as being cheap sexually. You know, put myself on the market by how I dress. By the language I use. There's an understanding of this. I had the pleasure of doing a course in a mental hospital. I got a good grasp. We had a woman who, in her middle 30s, had her first child, and she flipped out. She went psychotic shortly after this. And incidentally, her prognosis was tremendous because it was acute schizophrenia, not chronic. It came on just so instantly. The doctors were certain that with medication she'd be healthy the rest of her life. But what happened was, right after she had the baby, she thought she was Adam's wife, Eve. And she was in the garden and she went for a walk. Well, they didn't appreciate that on her block, okay, because she took off all of her clothes to go on the walk. And they brought her into the hospital, and I got to talk to her the second day she was sedated. We were supposed to do non-directive counseling, so we're talking along, and she's saying that she did this and she did that. She looked over, she said, would you have intercourse with me? And I did some good therapy. I said, why do you want to have intercourse with me? And her response was, so I can prove myself to you. And in so much loneliness, that's why so many people are offering themselves sexually. I'm flawed. I have no good. But maybe I can prove myself to you sexually. I can't see God damning people for doing that. I can just see him hurting and crying over the loneliness in their lives that lead them to do this. And in so many ways, hoping that they can kind of escape it. Do I use sex as a tool to get my way? And then maybe praying about one thing I can do, certainly. What can I do? What little thing can I do to continue to make myself feel better sexually? And I don't want to end on this note this time. I want to come back and put it in its full positive. I want you to remember this now, because there are so many hang-ups. I tell you, they come from religion. They come from Freudian psychiatry, the things we shove down and repress. They come from our culture. They come from our families. A perfect God selected sex as the best for his universe. God didn't settle for the better. He settled for the best. God could have had children made and families held together a variety of different ways. God picked sex as blessed, as chosen. And you got to see that. Our whole sexual orientation, our whole sexual life is blessed, it's chosen, it's appreciated, it's wanted by God. And if I misuse the Bible, that doesn't cause God to hate the Bible and want me to lose the Bible. If I misuse sex, that doesn't cause God to hate sex and want me to use it. At the same time, we should see that sex is only one part of us. It's an integral part, but it's only one part. It's a blessed part, but it's just one part.